You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a very, very windy day. I didn't know it was going to be windy this week, Don. What's up?
Well, you could have said a bright, beautiful, sunny day here in Northern California. It's been about a week of not bright, beautiful, sunny days here in Northern California. So it's a nice change. We just went through, 6 or 7 days of either raining or showery or overcast and pretty grim. We've got a lot of rain. We'll come back to that in a moment. But Lois and I are preparing this for Thursday broadcast. That means it's going to be broadcasting on Thanksgiving Day. Happy Thanksgiving to everyone who's listening, November 28th, 2024. The temperature today on the 27th is going up to a high of 56 degrees, and it's going to be sunny all day. The north wind is blowing. It's clear as a bell out there. Tonight will be 33 degrees, and there's going to be frost early Thanksgiving morning. Thanksgiving Day itself here in Northern California, it will be sunny and 54 degrees, and Thursday night, 31 degrees. And of course, there will be frost at that temperature. Again, don't worry about these frosts, please. I'll come back to that too, I guess. Friday, 55 degrees, and Friday night, 31 degrees. So mostly clear, then frost. And then Saturday, 54 degrees. Seems to be a pattern here. Frost Saturday night, then mostly sunny. But here's the wrinkle, and I suspect some of us in outer parts of the region will experience this likelier than frost. Saturday night, patchy fog, then patchy frost and patchy fog, 33 degrees. That's exactly the conditions the day my daughter was born 38 years ago, November 26th, when there was frost and fog. And I kept marveling to myself as I drove to the hospital at 30, 35 miles an hour. What an unusual circumstance that is. You don't usually have fog and frost together. Happy birthday, dear. Sunday, 57 degrees, areas of frost, and then mostly sunny. Sunday night, frost again. Monday, patchy frost, going to a high of 58. Monday night, unlikely to have frost, but likely to have fog, 38 degrees, and Tuesday sunny with a high near 58. What's going on here? Well, we've got a high pressure ridge building after all that series of storms came through. Again, we're going to be cold at night because it's going to be pretty still. And the ridging, as they call it, is expected to continue into the weekend, further into next week. Basically, dry conditions with light to breezy winds for at least the next 7 days. So after a week of rain, we're going to have a week of not rain. And there were some unbelievable rainfall totals around Northern California out of that series. It was really like one extended atmospheric river came in first out of the Gulf of Alaska, tapped into some warmer air coming over Hawaii, and as usual, pulling that warm air in. It was very wet, and there were some rainfall totals in the wine country and up in the Redding area that were 100-year records that fell. I'm looking at rainfall totals around the north part of Lake Berryessa and over into Sonoma and Napa counties, 17.5 inches, 21 inches, 12 inches. This isn't just one weird weather station with an anomalously high number. There is no weather station north of Lake Berryessa and up into that part of Lake County that had less than 12 inches. They all had 13, 14. Here's one with 12.5 inches, 15 inches. And the highest total was a peak up there on the Coast Range, which had 21.6 inches of rain over a 3 to 4 day period. Interestingly, very little flooding, just a whole lot of rain. And it soaked in. Lake Berryessa is rising, and it's only 10 feet from the overflow point already. So we know we're going to get there this year. And what's interesting is the rainfall totals down here in the valley. Vacaville got 3.5 inches. Dixon, Davis area, about 3 inches, maybe a little less. Up in Woodland, they only recorded, according to the site that I look at, 1.83 inches. So this really hit the Coast Range hard, the north part of the Bay Area, and then just tapered off. And if you were watching as it happened, there was almost a line that followed the interstate where the rain just stopped. And everything south of Interstate 80 basically got a half inch, an inch, maybe, you know, just a normal rainfall. But boy, wine country got saturated. The thing I would mention for gardeners here is that if you have heavy soil, 3.5-4 inches of rainfall all at once makes it very slick. So a lot of you really probably shouldn't be trying to plant things yet. Now, 5, 6, 7 days of dry weather, you may get out there and find in most parts of town, you'd be able to dig a hole and get planting. If you're trying to dig a hole and it's the sides of the hole are getting slick as you cut into them with a shovel, and the soil isn't breaking up as you dig it out, you're harming the soil structure. Better to just wait a few days, especially with dry, you know, north wind coming in, sunny days, 5, 6, 7 days, you should be able to get out there. My test is to walk out with a shovel, put it in, lift it up. If the soil starts to break apart, you're okay. It may be heavy. It might be a hard job to dig, but it's breaking apart. If it comes up as one big slick glob of mud, go do something else. Scatter some wildflower seeds. Throw some grass seed on your lawn. Make a meadow. Those are things you can do regardless of how saturated the soil is.
So my husband and I every morning go through and just do the weather for a few days. And it was like 54, 31, 54, 31, 31, 32, 31. And I'm going, ooh, that's not just a frost, that's a freeze. But I went to the graph that they have on that and the National Weather Service, and the graph shows you the temperature. Well, it turns out that 31, that was like for 5 minutes.
Shortly before or at sunrise, and that doesn't concern me. 31 degrees, as Lois points out, happening at 5 a.m., not a big deal. Cold injury is a function of how cold and for how long. Mm-hmm. And, important point, plants do gradually acclimate too cold, if they're from a region where it occurs, truly tropical plants, no. But there are actual metabolic changes within a plant when they're exposed to cold weather, and they essentially, to oversimplify, make their own antifreeze at that point. And most of them come through short intervals of expected temperatures below freezing without any problem. Yes, tender new growth might be nipped off of a plant. That happens here, by the way, more commonly perhaps in other places, where you get that, you know, surge of new growth on the citrus in October, and that gets nipped off by a frost because we have warm temperatures into October. First Saturday in October was 102 degrees. That was 7 weeks ago. So that first frost may have nipped off some of that growth, essentially done a very light pruning on the plant. I don't get concerned about cold temperatures till we get into the range that harms hardwood or semi-hardwood rather than green growth. I'm not concerned about a little nipping on the top of a lemon tree. I am concerned about a one-year-old lemon tree going down to 25 degrees. When that happened on my property, it was really bad for the lemon tree. So same tree, 3 years in the ground, no problem at all. So I guess that's the key, is that it's a matter of degree, but a couple nights at 31 degrees are normal and nothing to be concerned about. Well, in a well-run garden center, the things that are flowering at this time of year will not be harmed by cold weather. And the vegetables that you're planting will not be harmed by cold weather. Now, one interesting bit of climate change that has definitely occurred, anyone who's been here for 30, 40, 50 years, as both of us have, is aware of this, is a change in the nature of our December and January weather.
No more fog.
The fog, I mean, I've mentioned fog in the forecast, and it happens, and it's pretty and interesting, but it's maybe one day in the week, and it happens till 11 in the morning, or frequently it's in Dixon, and as I drive into Davis, it's not even happening. It was standard when people came here in the 70s and 80s for us to simply expect that between mid-December and the first week of January, it would be very gloomy. We would even tell people when we were selling vegetables and things, if you're planting them late November, don't be surprised. You're going to put them in. They're not going to do much at all at first because of this period of 3, 4, 5 weeks in which we just don't see the sun. And it's cold enough. Even daytime highs are only in the 40s, maybe low 50s because of the valley fog. First the tule fog and then the valley fog, making things very cold. Obviously, plants don't grow a lot under those conditions, but they won't be harmed by it. Well, they're also not harmed by a light frost. These are brassicas and lettuces and spinach and all those kind of leafy greens that people sell for the wintertime. They are not harmed by the temperatures we get here. Even when we've gotten down into the low 20s, there hasn't been harm on these young vegetables. So just be aware that the things you're buying now, assuming that they're being stocked correctly at your local garden center or hardware store, are appropriate to this region at this time. And they'll go through and the sun will come out again and they'll start to grow. But what's really happened, I mean, I go back and look at my pictures from Thanksgiving and Christmas. It's sunny now. It's sunny at Christmas. And when my parents used to come up and visit in the 1980s at Christmas, there was one time they visited for a week. We didn't see the sun the entire time. There was one day where the low was 32 and the high was 35. My parents were both cigarette smokers. They were not allowed to smoke in the house. So they put on their overcoats, they'd step outside on the porch, they'd huddle there at 33 degrees and smoke their cigarettes. And so they finally concluded maybe December isn't the best time to come to the valley. And they started.
Maybe they should stop smoking.
Well, that too, but coming up, that's harder to do. Coming up in spring and fall turned out to be an easier solution. Main point I want to make is, unless you hear that we're having like a really unusual cold air mass moving into the region, not just a high pressure ridge building, but the kind of thing that happened in 1990, 1998, very frigid air mass coming off the interior, moving down slowly. We have 4 or 5 days warning as this thing is moving towards us that it's going to be down much colder than usual. That did a lot of damage. People who were here in 1990, 1998, 2005, we had a similar one. It settled into the area. Eucalyptus trees in the Bay Area were killed to the ground. Citrus trees were seriously injured. That you need to be concerned about. Normal frost, normal November, December week, don't worry about it. You can help us celebrate 20 years of KDRT at a special edition of Suds and Sounds. Yes, you are cordially invited to a special expanded edition of Suds and Sounds, our monthly meet and greet at Armadillo Music in downtown Davis. Come together with Kadert's dedicated volunteers and friends, grab your beverage of choice, flip through the bins for some vinyl to spin between live sets from local music hero Alex Roth. That's Suds and Sounds, Wednesday, December 4, from 4 to 7 p.m.
RJ writes to us. Now, a year ago, RJ wrote to us about strawberries and the Albion strawberries. But now we've got a new message with pictures. Hi, Don and Lois. It's been almost a year since I wrote with strawberry questions, and I thought I'd give you an update. And then there's a picture of three wooden troughs, I guess you say, that are one above the other, with wood on the side holding the whole thing off the ground. So it's aerial and it's just sitting on concrete there, but it has little drippers going to each one. And it's a photo that he sent from November 17th, and it shows, oh boy, he has strawberries.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Boy. It's so November, he has strawberries. Okay. The tower has been a challenge. Yes. It's on a hot patio facing southwest, and the boxes are a bit shallow. The first soil we bought was cheap and too porous. The water drained right through. I replanted using better soil, including some native soil, good compost, and mulching with small wood chips. We connected it to the irrigation system used for the rest of the beds, but this system only goes off every other day throughout the summer. There's a planter on the backside which does pretty well, so rotating is not an issue. This past summer, these strawberries would have perished, or we wouldn't have never been able to go away if neighbor hadn't helped out with rewatering. Yeah. If we keep it at this location, we may have to switch out the basic timer unit for one that can do two separate programs. This is a lot of effort and water for strawberries. No wonder organic strawberries cost a lot.
Indeed.
If we were going to do this again, we would build bigger boxes to hold more soil and have added support struts. Okay.
So this I'm going to stop there. There's a couple points. This is a great illustration, so I'll probably use this as the illustration on the page at kdirt.org when I give the lead into the show. It's an excellent planter, and it shows the problem with growing strawberries here in the valley in a relatively small planter. It can be done, but the soil volume needs to be sufficient to keep them watered, or you literally do have to water daily. And I would think here during July, when we had a very above average entire month of temperatures and water use, even twice some days. So that's the first challenge, is that the boxes are shallow and you need more root volume if you possibly can. But I noted something. I replanted using better soil. That's the key right there. Soil that retains moisture. And then this phrase, including some native soil. Now, I know there's a lot of garden advisors out there who would jump up and go, oh, don't use native soil. You don't want to do that for one reason or another. Native soil retains moisture. So your garden soil has advantages in containers. I learned this years ago when I was doing a planter. It was going to be way down the driveway. Even though I was filling it with succulents, if I filled it with, good potting soil, it would dry out too quickly. So I put in about one part of our nice silty loam here on in the Dixon farm to about three parts of a good quality potting soil. And I could get by 10, 14 days between waterings. It was full of succulents, but it would hold water for several days after irrigating. If you don't have soil that you're comfortable to work with, earthworm castings, although rather pricey, are basically soil. I mean, if you look at them, their texture is like a sandy, gritty soil with composty stuff added, and they're finer textured than sand. So actually, earthworm castings can be a good additive to a potting soil mix if you're trying to retain moisture. That's the first thing. And then the other, good compost. Okay, that's great. Compost retains moisture, and mulching it with small wood chips. And I am personally consider mulching strawberries to be utterly crucial in several respects. First of all, for retaining moisture in that regard, shading the soil, helping to keep the moisture in. If it's bark, it's just shading the soil, but that's fine because there's another element is that when the flowers come up and the fruit sets and it leans back down and settles on to whatever is there, whatever that surface is, you got to make it harder for those sow bugs to climb up there. You've just got to give them a workout or else they're just going to come up. If it's touching the soil, any fruit touching soil gets eaten. I absolutely guarantee it. So that bark is very helpful in that regard. Okay, continue, please.
Okay, still talking about these planter boxes. It has been a successful strategy in several key ways. The slugs, pill bugs, and earwigs have not been a problem. Birds and roof rats have ignored it. It's too close to the house, perhaps, or maybe it's too tall. I don't know. Anyway, my ever helpful husband has also built two raised beds out in the regular garden area. And so now we have a separate picture. This is not aerial. These are sitting on the ground. These have a whole different set of problems, namely everything loves to eat them, pill bugs, earwigs, slugs, roof rats, raccoons, everything. The screen covers, and she has the picture shows a mesh cover that can be flipped over the top.
Real simple screen covers contraption that she's built here. This is great. Yeah.
And that's for the young plants, I think. So the screen cover helps keep out the roof rats and raccoons, but the earwigs especially are insatiable. I find earwigs curled up in the holes they've eaten, so I know it's earwigs.
Yep.
Newspaper traps just seem to make nice breeding colonies. Any suggestions? What about diatomaceous earth?
Okay, my impression of diatomaceous earth is that it really doesn't work very well. It's the idea is if you look at it under a microscope, it's very sharp and it would if they crawl through it, it would kill them by damaging their exoskeleton, which I suppose would work as long as it stays dry, but it tends to get wet quickly. And also, I've noticed insects just avoid it. My experience with earwigs is one of the simplest things to do. This may not be an option for you, but it works for me, is go out at night with a flashlight and a glove on your right hand, and you'll find them right up there, and you just squish them. You can kill a surprising number that way. But in the long run, your best bet for monitoring, as well as some degree of control, is oil traps, which is where you take a shallow bowl, and I confess, I use paper bowls for this purpose. Put a film of very aromatic oil in the bottom, maybe an eighth of an inch, a quarter inch. You don't need much. You just need a film of it down on the bottom. And the more fragrant, the better. And they smell it and they crawl in. And just as with beer and slugs, they crawl in and drown in the oil. And so you can go out, you can set a couple of these in the bed right next to your strawberries. It's totally non-toxic. And go out and do it at sunset because earwigs feed at night. Go out in the morning and you'll see how many you caught. And it can be very, very gratifying to find 20 or 30 earwigs drowned in olive oil. And by the way, olive oil worked really well for me because it's very aromatic, but other types of oil will be fine. You just don't want super light oil that they won't smell as well. So, corn oil works if you happen to use that. So the traps I originally did years ago for monitoring, and they really do a good job of that. It's kind of a what's causing the problem thing. Well, set some oil traps up, set some beer traps out if you want. Beer attracts snails and slugs, oil attracts earwigs. You'll see which your major problem is. Could be both for all we know. But earwigs are pretty intractable. Unfortunately, the reason you have a lot of them is that they're probably nesting in that planter. And I have found in my greenhouse, for example, I can figure out where in the greenhouse they're coming from, because the plants nearest to one side of the greenhouse will get damaged more than the plants on the other side. So if you notice a pattern to that, if you notice the plants down at one end are getting more eaten than the fruit down at the other end, set your traps there and monitor. But I do think that going out at night can be a real eye opener, can be kind of a fun family project. Everybody gets a flashlight. Be sure to wear a glove, because they do have a little pincher thing on the back, and just squish them right where they are and let them fall. That's very gratifying. But if you don't want to do that, oil traps can be very satisfying as well.
All right. I'm still talking about these planter boxes. They can be on the same water timer as the rest of the vegetable garden. I assume she means that because they hold water.
Much more soil volume, yes.
Yeah. Yes. We tried hugel culture using chunky wood chips at the bottom of these beds, as we didn't have enough soil.
I don't like that, because what that does is it just displaces soil with something that drains faster. It would be far better to get more soil in there. Hugel culture is a technique where you stack up logs and branches and organic stuff, and then you pile dirt on top of it. So essentially, you're just making your container shallower when you do that. You're reducing your soil volume. So in the long run, better to just fill it with soil. And also choose your soil carefully so that it retains moisture. But anyway, it looks like it worked. So far, so good is the answer. I just think hugel culture is probably not going to be helpful in this particular situation.
And if you actually go and read about hugel culture, it didn't start out being for planter boxes.
No, not at all.
People in the forests where they had, lots of downed trees and things like that, and they were making these mounds and these long rows of planting places. It's a fascinating thing to read about, but yeah. It doesn't seem to be appropriate in a dry culture like ours.
Yeah, no, I read it and I think this is definitely something you do in, Finland, where it rains all the time. But yeah. Rains all the time in a place where you have a lot of logs handy that you're trying to use up. It does seem a little odd here, but the main thing is when you do something like, and we just had someone in buying a big planter and wanted to fill the bottom of it with big chunky rocks and stuff, to enhance the drainage, end quote. Well, first of all, it doesn't do that. It doesn't help the drainage, but it just reduces your soil volume. So in general, in an arid climate, the more soil, the better, more actual soil, the better, whether it's a potting soil or garden soil. Putting in anything that displaces soil is, in my opinion, counterproductive. All right, go ahead.
Well, let's finish reading this. Between the three beds, we've had a handful of strawberries every day since May. The tower produces better tasting strawberries because I can let them ripen longer. They don't get eaten. So overall, it's a hard fought win. Several seasonal questions. Should tiny strawberries be thinned if one plant produces a big clump? I think you're talking about when they're little green things.
I don't think that matters. Just let them grow naturally. That's not a big concern.
Okay. Should the flowers just be snipped off at this time of year, since we only get 5 hours of good sunlight, like for the raised beds?
Again, I don't think that's necessary. They'll try and fruit. I've had, it's fun to go out there in December and see a strawberry. I can guarantee the sugar content won't be super high, but it doesn't really hurt the plant. The whole idea of the snipping off the flower, snipping off the fruit, is that it goes to the basic principle of plant physiology, that you're trying to conserve the plant's energy for other purposes. I don't think it's necessary in most cases, and so I wouldn't worry too much about it. It can be kind of fun. What you find a strawberry in January? Wouldn't that be entertaining?
Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah. Do strawberries need fertilizer between now and the spring?
No, they're going dormant. Strawberries do go into a sort of a dormant phase. It wouldn't hurt them to feed them, but they really wouldn't make use of it particularly. So it probably would just drain right through the box and be a benefit to whatever plants have the roots in the ground nearby. They do go dormant. They're a deciduous plant mostly, but here in the valley and in other parts of California where we're mild climate, they don't go completely bare like a peach tree does. However, when they do go into that dormant period, it's actually a very useful time to take a gentle rake and rake through the bed very carefully, because what that does is it pulls out the older, woodier plants, leaving mostly the runners. And that means you're rejuvenating your bed. Generally speaking, a single strawberry plant will produce well the first year after you plant it. The yield declines pretty heavily in the second year, and by the third year, it's gotten woody, and that individual plant in your bed is not producing very well. So removing those individual plants would be great if you could figure out which ones they were, but the simple way to do it is to just take a leaf rake and gently rake through the bed sometime January, February, gently, okay? And you'll be pulling out, breaking off the older crowns and leaving the new healthy ones. And that is when they're at their greatest dormancy. But in terms of fertilizer, I wouldn't bother with anything till late winter, early spring. And pretty much just like all other fruit, they just basically need nitrogen. So to get it past the mulch, which is going to be an issue, you know, mulch will tend to tie up granular forms of fertilizer for a while. A soluble fertilizer, whether it's fish emulsion, or whatever your favorite brand of plant food is, applied as the plants begin to grow in February, and just watering it in so it goes past the mulch or straw. And again, sprinkling granular fertilizer will work, but it takes a lot longer. So I just find with containers, personally, I prefer to use soluble fertilizers, or I top dress the whole thing. This is what I commonly do with my highly enriched potting soil that I sell at my garden center, which functions practically as a fertilizer. I go ahead and spread a layer of half an inch or so right on the surface, rake it off the leaves, wash it off the leaves, and that contains enough fertilizer to take care of the needs of the strawberry plants during the spring. So either way, soluble fertilizer applied at the time growth begins, or top dressing just before growth begins, really nothing to do until about February here in the Sacramento Valley.
Okay, she wants to use a mulch. So what type of mulch would be best to apply? Wood chips, straw mulch? Does it matter when you put it on?
In this case, we do use chips or straw because you want something chunky like that. You want a gap from the soil below. You're not generally trying to enrich the soil. You're just trying to make this area to protect the fruit. Your main goal, as they're finding, as we have found, is to get that fruit ripe before something eats it and be able to pick it yourself and enjoy it and everything like strawberries. So your goal is to get it up off the ground and cover the plants over. And I see that that's been done here with the wire cage cover that's being used in terms of the birds and the other things that like to get in there and eat strawberries. And so basically you just want some chunky mulch, and bark or straw are both fine. I've used both of them with very good results.
Do you have to remove them every year before you fertilize? No.
No, just make sure your fertilizer will get through them. That's the key of our earlier conversation, is that if you put granular fertilizer on top of bark or straw to a degree, but especially bark, it just kind of sits there and then slowly gets dissolved each time you overhead water. And if you're using drip, you're not overhead watering. So it's more effective if you're going to use a granular fertilizer. Nothing wrong with them, but if you're going to use one, take it and shake it down through the leaves onto the soil below. So sprinkle it on, shake of leaves, wash everything off to get it down in contact with the actual planting soil, potting soil, and it'll be more effective. But simpler perhaps just to use a soluble fertilizer.
Okay. And thank you to Ruth from Carmichael for sending that message to us. We do like to see what's happening with our listeners.
Yeah, these are great. You can send your questions, comments, and brags and boasts to davisgardenshow@gmail.com. Strawberries are easy to grow. Really, there's a lot that goes wrong with them, but they're also very easy to grow. They're easy to increase. They send out runners, and you can make new plants from them. They're pretty cheap. Nurseries almost always have them at low prices. And these new varieties, the start of this is Albion. Albion is what's called an ever-bearing variety, which, by the way, that particular one won a taste trial that I was at. I was off giving a presentation to the Sacramento Master Gardeners with like 50, 75 people in attendance, quite a large turnout. And they had a bunch of bowls of strawberries over to the side. It was a June presentation and they were unlabeled. So we didn't know what they were. And Albion was hands down the winner for flavor. I mean, it was not even close. Albion is a relatively new introduction. It's called Everbearing, which means that unlike your old-fashioned strawberries, it doesn't just produce late May and June. That's what we call those June-bearing. It continues to flower and set fruit into the summer. My experience has been that means it continues to set into July, and you can pick in August, but it also can flower and set almost any time. So you can get a late summer blossom and fruit on them, and as noted here, you can be picking pretty much any time. So these ever-bearing types were first big hits with home gardeners. Many of them have become important commercial varieties as well. So watch for some of those. There's a bunch of good varieties of strawberry, but Albion is really an outstanding one that most people aren't aware of, that just has amazing flavor and produces very well over a long period of time.
All right, let's talk about the tree that has an. Don, you need to tell me the names of this before I get started. City of Davis has a plan, a process where they put signage on certain trees, landmark trees. Is it landmark trees? Is that what we're saying?
Something like that, yeah. Yep.
Okay, good. Five, four, three. So, Don, I want to talk about the landmark tree that we have at the Quaker Meeting House. Well, actually, that's not what I want to talk about. But someone wrote in and said, "What's that incredible tree with the showy pods at the intersection of 8th and L?"
And
And
that one is a landmark tree. That one really should have a sign of its own because it's pretty much the first of this species that achieved great size in off out of the arboretum. This is in town, and you, as you've noted, have one. There's one at the
at our house.
Friends Meeting House. This one on the corner of 8th and L has brilliant red pods that start that flowers in October, and the pods form immediately. And I have one in my meadow, and the pods are now blazing red. It's quite spectacular. I call it my holiday tree because it holds these pods all the way into December. The official name of this tree, people ask me about it all the time, Coleuteria, Coleuteria, Coleuteria elegans. Coleuteria elegans. Common name that I learned with it is Formosan flame tree. There are two other species of Coleuteria, both of which are planted around the area, and one of them is planted in much colder climates as well. So there's Coleuteria paniculata, the golden rain tree. Don't plant it. Just right there. Don't plant that tree. Reseeds like crazy, gets a horrible bug, should not be planted. Coleuteria bipinnata looks like that, but as the species name bipinnata tells us, it has twice pinnate leaves, so it's very ferny looking, and it recedes a bit, but and could be a nuisance, so we'd want to be cautious about planting too many of those. They're around the area, but Coleuteria elegans doesn't flower fruit until late in the season, so most of those pods never get mature seeds. The common name, Formosan flame tree, botanical name, Coleuteria elegans. Now, if you go to look it up, you'll find this is invasive in southern Florida, probably parts of southern Texas as well. In truly subtropical climates like USDA Zone 10 or certainly 11, it can reseed quite a bit. There are reasons, however, that it's not in the nursery trade. So, one of the reasons I want to mention this, if you see that beautiful tree and you walk in to ask me if I can get it for you, the answer is nope, I cannot get that tree.
And the reason you can't get it is that you don't want to, or that it's hard to seed. I mean, on our property, we have never yet had a seed come up from that tree. I wouldn't mind having a few seedlings, but they don't make it.
I have grown seedlings from my own tree and from an isolated tree that I'm aware of in North Davis. And we got about a 3% germination rate on the seeds. So if you want 10 or 20 trees, you're going to have to plant a couple hundred seeds. So that's the first thing. They're not typically viable. Now, I made that comment in a tree evaluation committee group that I'm working on. Someone from the Arboretum said, interesting to note, seedlings are coming up under those trees in the Arboretum. So there are seedlings coming up. My experience with seedlings on my farm, when I planted a young 1 gallon tree out, it froze. I planted another one, it froze. Another one, it froze. I had to plant four, carefully purchased for me from the Arboretum sale, year after year after year, before one of them got through its first winter. So right there, you have your first problem for wholesale growers in Northern California. The young tree in a 1 gallon can, which is what they would be carrying through the first winter, would need to be protected. They're not going to do that with a tree that has a marginal market to begin with. So they would freeze. And so Northern California growers simply aren't going to grow this thing. I was curious, though, about the ones in the Arboretum, since a docent, as well as someone active in the administration there, mentioned to me seedlings are beginning to come up under Coleuteria elegans in the Arboretum. I suspect you could help yourself, although I wouldn't suggest doing that without permission. My guess is that those are probably hybrids. Because a well-known individual at the Arboretum, who leads walks on Wednesday periodically, dug one up and took it out to his place and planted it, thinking he was getting a Coleuteria elegans, and pretty quickly realized he had a hybrid, a cross between Coleuteria elegans and Coleuteria bipinnata. The hybrid will not be as showy won't be as attractive. And so it wouldn't have the advantages of the elegans. And I might, my guess, although I can't confirm this 100%, is that those seedlings coming up around the elegans in the arboretum are probably hybrids. I've never had a seedling come up under my tree. And we're talking about thousands of pods every year. And as you mentioned at the Friends Meeting House, seedlings are not coming up. So my guess is that Colorataria elegans simply has a very, very poor germination rate. And that's certainly been our experience. We grew a crop of them a couple of years ago. Took 2 years to get 15-gallon trees, and we only got a 3% germination rate. So this isn't going to move into our production schedule very quickly for something with a fairly limited market. It's a little bit frost tender here when it's young, especially. If you look at my tree, you can see where 5 or 6 years in, we had another hard freeze here, got killed back to the branches and then sprouted out again. So out in the outlying areas, as we are, when you get down to 25 degrees or below, this tree will likely be injured. In town, there are many well-established specimens. So Tree Davis and the City of Davis have planted them in a number of places. So you will see these very attractive trees setting their pods, usually red, sometimes orange, sometimes pink around the area. We're not going to be planting very many more because of the concern about possible reseeding, but they are part of the urban forest now in the City of Davis. And that one specimen, which has been there for at least 30 years, 35 years or more, is one of the very first that went in back before the internet. The gentleman who lived at that house, who was a good customer, said he just kept Xeroxed copies of a page that he had written up about it by his front door. So the people who would come to the front door and knock on it would say, "What's that tree?" He would just hand them a copy of his informational handout on Colorataria elegans. Does great here, but there are some issues and you're certainly going to have trouble getting a hold of it. Happy to give you seed. If you ever want to try and grow it yourself, holler and I'll give you 100 seed and you can see if you can get 3 of them to sprout.
Okay, I'm looking at the November calendar, and as listeners who've been around for a while know, all these pictures were pictures Don took at some November. Okay.
Yeah. Yes.
I have non-flowers on here. I've got ornamental kale. I've got a pomegranate looking ripe. Persimmons, yep. Fuyu persimmons looking ripe, and kumquats looking ripe.
Yeah, the citrus, so citrus harvesting. Are very. Yeah, there's citrus that's very pretty through the winter, even if it's things that you don't particularly eat. But yeah, kumquats. How do you like kumquats, Lois?
You are never going to let me forget that, are you? Never, never.
Lois did a TV show years ago, and I handed her a kumquat on the air and said, "No, you just pop it in your mouth and chew it up." She did on camera. It was great. They're very pretty, very ornamental. Someone just brought me a picture of a citrus in their yard, and they brought me a sample of it, too, to try and figure out what it was. They had purchased it from me about 10 years ago. They had forgotten what it was and could not figure out exactly what it was. It's a calamondin. I was able to peel it and smell it and, you know, very recognizable aroma to it. They'll have anywhere from 100 to 200 fruit on them hanging on all through the winter and into the spring and summer, as kumquats also do, looking very ornamental. Yes, they're edible in their own certain way, but they're also very ornamental and colorful midwinter. But
okay, so we've talked about leaves, and I won't go over those, but the flowers that are listed here are borage, which is another true blue flower, a little tiny thing.
Yeah.
Bees love it.
Yeah.
And pansies. Well, pansy is the marker, but pansy viola, all those things, Johnny Jump Ups, all that crowd.
Yep.
And then we have salvias that we've already talked about. Mm-hmm. And a abutilon. Oh, Don, this is a gorgeous abutilon. This one is orange and yellow striped. Wow. I don't have this one.
There's a lot of abutilon and they will try to bloom anytime. I've had funny conversations with people like, "When do I prune my flowering maple?" That's the common name for them. My abutilon. When do I prune it? I'm told you shouldn't prune things when they're blooming. I thought, well, then you'll never prune it because it's always an issue with flowers. You prune it whenever you want to. But they vary quite a bit. Some of them look rough in the winter because they kind of curl their leaves when it's cold. But even the coldest weather events have not injured my abutilon here. And again, I'm out in the country. Admittedly, they're usually close to the house or close in. All of mine are under the protection of a great big London plane tree. But still, they don't get injured. If you want to prune them for size control, I usually do it in the spring. But, you know, if they look rangy, don't hesitate to do it now. What else is on that list?
So, well, before I got off of abutilons, at the front of my house, I had this big 3/4 barrel, which is something that I haven't seen in 30 years. But it was huge, and it was filled with dirt, I mean, potting soil. Excuse me.
Soil. Please. And never soil. Call it dirt. Never call it dirt.
Anyway, it had two or three abutilons in it. And one was that red one that gets so tall. It was really big. And the barrel was falling apart. So I got some people here to take it out of that and put it in a new thing, which is about half barrel size. It isn't as tall, but then this thing was like 2 feet down from the lip anyway. So it is okay. Well, everything died. Everything just died. Okay. And I thought I had lost the whole thing. So I just cut it all back. I left about, 3 feet of stalk, of stem there, cut off the top 6 or 7 feet. And poor little thing died. Except I ignored it, yeah. But I watered because there were campanulas in there. And it came back.
Yes, never give
it
up on
it. It not only came back, it is now even prettier than it was before, because now it has leaves all the way down from the bottom up, because that stuff usually, drops its leaves at the base and you end up with a stick with leaves on the top.
So I just had a similar conversation with someone who had planted something and they didn't know whether it was dead and wanted to know how to figure it out. Well, you can do the scratch test, the bend test, the prune test. They all amount to the same thing. You obviously, if a plant dies from lack of water, it's going to die predominantly from the top down. As it loses moisture, the furthest point from the roots will be the first to wither. You can start cutting. What I prefer to do is start bending. Bending the branches. In their case, it was a kufia, but it's relevant to any of these types of things. If it snaps, that part is dead. Go down another 6 inches, bend it. If it snaps, that part is dead. Go all the way down if you have to. You can go in with your thumbnail and scratch the bark if you don't really want to prune, and just keep scratching again further down. And if you have it, if it's tan or brown, then it's dead. But if it's green, it's alive. And somewhere down there, probably at some point, maybe all the way down just a few inches above the soil, you're likely to run into living tissue. And as we like to say, where there's protoplasm, there is hope. So if you can cut it back to that point, fine. You can wait. She wanted to know, should I wait? Should I prune? Well, dead stuff isn't great to have there for one reason or another. So it'll be, if you could figure out what part is dead, as I just described, bending, breaking, cutting, then removing all the dead portion is considered the best practice. But if you want to wait until some of those buds further down actually break and grow, as they likely will do at some point when the temperatures and the soil moisture reach what is appropriate for whatever the plant species is, then you can wait till then and then cut it back. There are ways to tell if a part of the plant is alive or dead, and it's either the bend, break, scratch, or cut test.
I'm going back to the calendar, Don. Brugmansia. It's a trumpet-shaped thing. It hangs down, and it's big, and it's golden.
Angel's trumpet. This particular one is the variety Charles Grimaldi. Every part of this plant is toxic. Be aware of that. I've had this in my backyard for 35 years now. And it always does this thing to me where it's initiating flowers in October. And it's a race against time because the top of my plant always gets injured by cold. If you're in town, closer in, you are not likely to have as much cold injury on yours as I get on mine. Why do I grow a plant that's highly toxic that only blooms late in the season? Because the fragrance.
I don't know, Don. Why do you?
The fragrance of these flowers is amazing. It's overpoweringly fragrant, and they're stunning flowers. It's one of these things that's particularly fragrant, only fragrant actually, after dark in the evening and at night. It happens to be a few feet from my kitchen window. So when it's blooming, you open the window, this fragrance goes through the whole house. But I want people to know that Angel's Trumpet is toxic. So be aware of that if you're thinking of planting one, because they're big. Mine hits 8 to 10 feet every year, and I generally cut it back pretty hard as we go into the spring. There are some of these around town in places where you can see them almost like trees. A couple of the restored Victorian homes up in Woodland, there's one of them where there's two of these flanking the entrance. And when they're in bloom, there's 300 or 400 blooms on them all at once. There have been some at the White Garden, the Arboretum in the past. I have a picture of that one. Half frozen. We had a very cold snap a few years back, and I went over there to see what had happened. And the part out in the open away from the gazebo was completely frozen and black, and the part closer to the gazebo, nearer the concrete, looked fine, and the blooms were still looking wonderful. So it illustrated beautifully the impact of microclimate. So it's one of those plants where you have to be aware that we sometimes get cold enough to injure them, and it's going to be hard for a lot of people to find a place in their yard for them, knowing that every aspect of this plant is toxic. But if you have the right place, they're worth it.
So that flower looks big. Is it about as long as your forearm?
Yeah, there's 8 to 10.
And so how big around is the opening at the bottom?
About 5 inches. It's probably pollinated.
So you could get a whole hummingbird in there.
Yeah,
you?
More likely you're going to see a sphinx moth or a bat.
Ah, okay. All right. And then the last one you have on this page is geranium roseanne.
Yeah, this is a geranium, a true geranium, not a pelargonium geranium. This one came on the market 15 or 20 years ago. It won all kinds of awards in the UK and other places. It was, I think, plant of the decade at one point in Britain. It's a blue, okay, lavender, lilac, purple. It's a blue-purple flower, and it blooms heavily in the spring and fall. Many of the geraniums, as we call them, not, again, I've got to distinguish this. These are not the thing your grandma called a geranium, which is a pelargonium. These are in the genus geranium. Crane's bill is the common name. There are dozens of cultivars. You look at old Western garden books, they had maybe 5 listed. Now you get the most recent edition 10 years ago. There's 30, 40 different kinds of geranium. They're great for mild climates. So Oregon, mild in the sense of not super hot and dry. Most of them aren't real happy about our valley heat. Many of them do fine here, though, if you put them in light shade and only expect them to bloom in the spring and fall. In other climates, they bloom through the summer. Roseanne is a particularly prolific bloomer and does very well here in the valley as long as it's not in the hottest sun. And there's a couple of other of these geraniums that are the same way. And my observation with Roseanne is anytime you're out of extreme heat or extreme cold, it's likely to be blooming with this lovely lilac color. So geranium Roseanne, it needs irrigation. This is not for low water landscapes, but it rewards you with lots and lots of flowers. It would go well with violas, the perennial violas. It would go well with campanulas. It goes very well with hellebores, those kinds of plants. It makes a lovely herbaceous perennial with lots of bloom.
Don, you said something amazing. Perennial viola?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Lots of, well, technically all violas are considered perennial because they are somewhere. I've seen nurseries sell violas and pansies as perennials because if it doesn't get too hot and dry in the summer, they'll make it through the summer. Most of them get through the winter just fine. But if you look, the genus Viola encompasses huge numbers of plants, including many that are native to North America, including some that are native to California. And there's also some that are popular garden perennials, such as Viola heteracea, the Australian violet, Viola odorata, the sweet violet. It has its issues, but it's definitely perennial. Viola labradorica, which is a ground covering one with purple foliage that has a reasonably pretty flower. So a lot of violas, in fact, in general, violas are perennials. Many of them are ground covers. All of them are woodsy kind of plants. So the only reason we sell pansies and violas here as winter or cool season annuals is that we hit 90 degrees in May, they stretch, they fall apart, they look terrible in the summertime. They often don't even make it through the summer, but they would be perennial if you're a little milder in the summertime.
So I guess my confusion was, I know violets are perennials because, yes, I can't have those. I hadn't realized that violets and viola were the same thing. I was thinking that viola was just that one narrow group of things that
it's actually a big genus, and there's lots and lots of them, and there's really interesting, almost everywhere that you have deciduous forests, you have violas of one species or another growing on the ground underneath those trees. That's the kind of place they're happiest.
So last week I took a camera and I took a picture of everything I could find that had a flower on it. Boy, I was amazed at how much stuff is out there. And you got to tell me what this thing is. Is there such a thing as a Texas Ranger that has silver foliage and white drops on a raceme with pink on it?
You were doing fine until we got to the white drops on a raceme with pink on it, but there is a silver leaf Texas Ranger. Yes. Yeah.
But they're blue. Aren't they blue?
No, they're magenta.
Oh, so this pale pink that I've got could be a Texas Ranger.
Yeah, Texas Ranger, that's a great shrub for this area. Leucophyllum texanum, there are a bunch of cultivars. The one that came on the market has very silver foliage. I have the more pale greenish gray one. That's a plant. It's sort of like bottle brush in this regard. It goes into heavy bloom all at once every 2 to 3 months, year round. It doesn't really care what the season is. And I have never seen a plant as active with bees as a Texas Ranger in bloom. Now, the picture that Lois is showing me right now is a very lovely salvia. Salvia lucantha.
What's a salvia?
Salvia lucantha. And the Mexican sage is a great plant here for late fall and early winter. And there's a bunch of other salvias. I mean, it's a huge genus. And there's salvias that bloom every time of year. But the fall blooming ones, the autumn sages, which come from the Southwest, are still in heavy bloom. And the Mexican sage, there are two salvias called Mexican sage. This is Salvia lucantha. L-E-U-C-A-N-T-H-A. And that is the purple flowered salvia that grows and has these fuzzy flowers on long racemes and plants that kind of sprawl. So it's a big floppy plant and it's just hardy enough in zone 9B. We talked at the beginning of the show about zones 9A versus 9B. My salvia lucantha usually gets killed. Completely.
But mine is right at the back of the house, and the house is facing south, so it's going to make it fine.
People in town rarely have problems with Salvia lucantha, but people out in the country, you may get top injury. And people on the coast plant this thing, and it blooms all the time. It's in bloom almost any season, and they clip them and shear them and so on. Well, just a quick thing about pruning that particular plant. It functions like a, even though it looks woody and it looks like a shrub, Salvia lucantha functions like a true herbaceous perennial, meaning all that stuff that's blooming and about to flop down with this, all the rain is going to kind of drive it down onto the ground. When it's done blooming, you look down at the base of the plant, already pushing up are the shoots for next year. You don't have to prune all that stuff off the top. It will continue to bloom lightly in the future. But if you want to rejuvenate them, it's a really easy thing to do. Just go to your Salvia lucantha when it either looks rough because the storms have pounded into the mud, or it's spring and you hadn't worried about it. And you can see exactly where to cut. Cut all that old stuff off, leave all the new stuff. It'll flush out and the plant will be very nicely rejuvenated that way. By comparison, the autumn sages, Salvia greggii, Salvia microphylla, the hybrids that are sold as Salvia jamesonii, which are basically hybrids between those first two, they bloom off and on all the time, but they give a heavy bloom in the autumn, so they're called autumn sage. Those are a little harder to figure out how to prune because they are woody. They make a shrub, and it isn't quite obvious where to cut them to. But I can tell you from both experience and accident that I have pruned them every way possible, and it works very well. You can cut them back hard if you want to. And so a lot of those salvias are still blooming, and they do come in true blue in some cases, also pink, red, white and red. Hot lips is a very popular one, and they're very attractive to hummingbirds. It's just a matter of if you wait for them not to be blooming to prune them, you'll probably never prune them because they're always in bloom at least a little bit. And if you try to figure out exactly where to cut them, like, you know, some sort of strategic thinning or rejuvenation pruning, they don't lend themselves to that. Just do what the guy with the tractor did to mine. Mow him every now and then. He does it in the spring. And the first time he did it, I thought, oh God, I'm going to have to replace all those. Nope, they all came back just beautifully. So a hard rejuvenation pruning in the spring is just fine for many of your woody salvias, especially the Southwestern species.
So the first one that I talked about, the one that I thought was lucantha, this is the first year I have noticed these long strands of beautiful flowers and, you know, going up 2 feet and arching out and all that sort of stuff. I think what happened is that I didn't know much about this plant. It got planted and then ignored. It was a little plant. And so then every once in a while, a few little flowers would come on, but it didn't make any of these big things until this year when I cleared out everything that was dead.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden this year, these huge, lovely, beautiful, they're great.
Yeah. And there's also, just for the record, there is a more compact version. I think it's called Santa Barbara, which just stays tighter. This is a big plant. Salvias should be given room in general. People cram them really close together. Each of them typically needs 3 to 4 feet of space. In the case of the ones that aren't California natives, the Southwestern natives and this Mexican sage, our native sages, by the way, Clevelandi and some of the others, many of them get 6 to 8 feet across. They're fantastic plants if you have room for that. They're wonderful wildlife habitat. Their flowering season is shorter, but they don't prune as well, has been my experience. But the southwestern species and the Salvia lacantha, the Mexican sage, renewal pruning can be very helpful. And then they need 3 to 4 feet of space. If you don't have that, look for the tighter growing one called Santa Barbara. Also, there's a pink one, pink flowered one, and a white flowered one. And when I first heard about that, I thought, well, that seems boring. Why would you do that when you can do the purple one? Then I brought them in to the nursery. Why not? See if they sell, and made a display of the pink and the white and the purple. This was a couple of years ago. It's a great combination. So if you have room for more than one Mexican sage, look around for the pink one or the white one. They do make an excellent combination. And they're really showy with those fuzzy flowers that kids think are really cool. So Mexican sage is a great choice, certainly for the coastal areas of California, most of Southern California, and zone 9B. Zone 9A, you may get some top injury on it because getting down to the 25 degrees seems to be kind of a threshold for that particular plant.
So one of all those flowers that I took pictures of, then there was one that isn't blooming, but it came out in January last year. I was so shocked to see it because it's a bird of paradise and it looks so tropical. But you know what, Don? If you look at the bush, no, it is not really a bush. It all grows from the ground.
It's a rhizome forming perennial, yes.
Giant yeah. Leaf. And it's got those flower stalks already up, starting to bend over. It hasn't bloomed yet, but I was amazed to see it. It's only November.
They will bloom midwinter. Yeah, the important thing to know about bird of paradise, I grew up with lots of those in San Diego. They can become a pretty big overgrown clump of roots with leaves, and they can get a little rough looking. One of my main jobs as a teenager at one of the places I worked was thinning out bird of paradise to get the ratty looking leaves out. That bud that you just posted a picture of will be present in bud bloom and post bloom for a year. It's on the tree for a very, very, very long time. So people often send me pictures of their bird of paradise. Look, Don, it's blooming midwinter. Yeah, yes, that bloom came out in probably August and could hang on the plant for a very long time. It's one of the reasons they're very popular. And for those of you listening who are fairly new to this area, we're talking about bird of paradise, which is being sold as a house plant. Just for record, oh, yes, it's become a very popular houseplant. One, it's very unlikely to bloom indoors, although it makes a very good houseplant for foliage. It's easy to grow indoors, extremely unlikely to bloom indoors, but gives a nice tropical air. Yes, they are hardy enough to grow outside here in the Sunset Zone 14, the USDA zone, let's say 9B, even 9A, because even in the major freeze of 1990, there were some big clumps of them downtown Dixon, right on the main street there that I used to look at all the time. And they were frozen to the ground at 16 degrees. We were sure they were dead. Whoever owned the house cut them off clean at the ground level, and they sprouted right back up and came back. So they're perfectly cold hardy. It did take a couple of years for them to bloom again. So this very familiar tropical looking plant from Southern California and Hawaii and places like that does grow here. This is the regular bird of paradise. I have seen the big tropical one growing here, and it makes a big dramatic plant. But the only places I've actually seen it our courtyards. So if you happen to have the giant bird of paradise out in the open and you're somewhere in the Sacramento Valley, send me a quick note because I'd be curious if it's done well for you during any of our major cold events. It's a very banana looking plant. I mean, it gives that tropical look that people are after, but I'm not completely convinced it's as cold hardy as the shorter one.
We usually end the show with a garden quote. And I want you to know that gardening has been an activity done by humans for a long, long, long time.
Yes.
And this quote comes from an ancient person named Cicero, and it's translated into English, and it says, if you have a garden and a library, you have everything you need.
There we go. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.